The upsides and downsides of migraines and madness.
When you read what people have to say, they often describe, you know, one or two of the most exalted moments in their life being, you know, just before or just after a migraine headache.
That's Andrew Levy. We talked to him today about his migraine memoir, A Brain Wider Than the Sky.
I think it's a gift. I really am actually pretty proud to be bipolar.
And we'll also air an archived interview with David Lovelace about his memoir of bipolar disorder, Scattershot. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. More than 10%, 32 million, of Americans suffer from migraines, those debilitating headaches that make all sound and light intolerable for the victim. Andrew Levy's first migraine came when he was only 6 years old. 3 years ago, they got much worse. He was bedridden for months, racked by pain and nausea that came like clockwork every morning and retreated only in the late afternoon. To cope, he started keeping a diary, a migraine diary. Levy began by detailing his own experience and how his migraines affected his family. But it soon led him to explore the history, science, art, and metaphysics of migraine. A Brain Wider Than the Sky opens a way to healing not the body, but the mind for sufferers of any chronic pain, physical or mental. Andrew Levy teaches English at Butler University, and he's the author of several previous books, including The First Emancipator. Andrew Levy, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Levy, I never thought I would want to read a book about migraines until I picked up your wonderful book, A Brain Wider Than the Sky. I found it to be profound, fascinating, very moving. You are a migraine sufferer. This is subtitled A Migraine Diary. How did the idea of doing this book come to you?
It was kind of demanded itself. I was actually writing a book about Mark Twain, and then I got a headache that started one day in August and didn't go away till December of that particular year. And by the time it was done, I was writing a book about migraines instead. It was almost part of the cure.
Part of the cure. How was that? Did you cure your migraines with writing?
No, because I still get them. But you can sort of change your place on the spectrum, so to speak. I think that part of a migraine is the panic, the depression, the oppressiveness that comes with it. But I think if somehow you feel that you've gotten control of the situation, or at least in a certain sense you're having a partnership rather than just being overwhelmed every time a migraine happens, that you do get control of the pain. And once it's just pain, once it's pain without panic, pain without sadness, pain without depression, you can start to be happy.
Happy.
Happy. Yeah, this is a big deal. I think that people, something I've learned a lot actually after I published the book, is I've talked to people with chronic pain conditions, and they say that the moment that happens where they realize that despite a chronic pain condition, they can have a happy life, they can have a productive life, that's the breakthrough moment.
For those of us who've never had a migraine, although I'm sure all of us have experienced pain, if not physical pain, just the chronic pain condition of life, tell us what it's like to experience a migraine, at least for you.
Well, for me, migraines, most people think headaches, but they're also a constellation of neurological symptoms, which can include a real a thick-tonguedness that you say words you didn't even mean to say, partial blindness. The three actually sure signs that your headache is a migraine is that you really hate light, you really hate sound, and that you're really nauseous, none of which are actually head pain. But, what most people think about and talk about is the head pain, which for me, it's usually a headache which sort of starts with premonitions of a headache in the mid to late morning, and then will become a headache if I don't treat it properly, or which could be anything from taking a drug to going to a quiet, dark room. And then for me, it's a headache that runs until sunset. For some people, their migraines can go for days. for some people, as I had 3 years ago, it can be a migraine every day for 3 or 4 months. That's called a transform migraine. For some people, it's just the aura, the neurological symptoms like partial blindness or hallucinations with no headaches. For some people, it's headaches without the aura. So a migraine is kind of a multifarious little beast. For me, basically, it's premonitions of a headache followed by a really sort of crippling headache.
The migraine actually takes on a far greater spectrum, or dimension actually, I think is a better word, a far greater dimension than this physical phenomenon that you're talking about. In fact, there were points in the book where I almost wished I could have a migraine.
Yeah, some people have said that, and it's because there's a pretty long legacy of celebrated migraine sufferers who also describe experiencing, you know, a clear-headedness or an elation, sometimes just before the migraine, or sometimes just after. And, you know, Virginia Woolf said that after a migraine that she felt like sand that a wave had just uncovered, that she felt that clear, and that a lot of people have had, famous people have had these incredible fugues of creativity right after a period of migraines. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence right after, you know, 6 weeks of headaches. Sigmund Freud came up with many of his great sort of breakthrough psychoanalytical concepts right after migraines. This list is actually pretty extensive. And you know, the hallucinations, they can be quite striking. They can be quite mind-opening. I mean, it's all chemicals and electricity inside your brain, but it can feel pretty spiritual.
Well, when Virginia Woolf says she felt like the sand that a wave has just uncovered, why do you think migraine actually brings that kind of clarity? Because you're really not talking about, you know, some people might think, well, you know, just when something stops hurting, you know, it feels so good. But you're really talking about a much greater level of clarity than that.
There's two different things. One is that, yeah, which is after 3 weeks of headaches, when it goes away, you feel great, and you feel like you've passed through something. A period of sort of intense torment clears, and your brain feels renewed, refreshed, almost like rebooting an operating system in a computer. But there are, you know, migraines are about waves of electricity inside your brain. There's a 19th century doctor who called them nerve storms, which I think is a great analogy, because they feel like, you know, sort of a wave of electricity just washing across your brain, activating pain receptors as it goes. Electricity, serotonin washing around, these are a lot of the sort of chemical and electrical components of elated states in mankind. And a lot of that is happening too.
And in fact, mystical states.
I think so, and that's something I sort of challenge in the book, which is, I sort of ask the question that what if it turned out that most mystical states that we've seen described in our religious literature turned out to have been migraines or other sort of neurological disruptions? What if we had an earthbound explanation for the moments that people see God? You know, are we disappointed by that, or can we be elated again at the idea that this has been built into the system?
Well, could you say more about that?
Yeah, well, for instance, there's I think three Swiss and German neurologists who have, you know, did a little Bible, a textual reading, and came up with the idea that Peter on the road to Damascus is actually having a migraine, the thorn in the flesh in the side, 3 days where he can neither eat or drink after a flash of light, that the entire thing is actually a pretty good description of a lot of migraine symptoms, and that, of course, is a transformational moment in his life. You know, over and over in the literature, when you read what people have to say, they often describe, you know, one or two of the most exalted moments in their life being, you know, just before or just after a migraine headache. And I've interviewed a fair number of people who've only had one migraine in their life, which is completely, you know, doable, and they remember it perfectly. And what they remember is a dramatically altered state, not just a headache. For some people, it can just be a headache, but for a lot of people, it's an altered state.
Could you describe more some of the visual effects, like the aura, for example? Could you talk about what happens?
Sure. Well, in my case, when I was 6 years old, I would just see shimmering stars just dancing around in front of my line of sight. And when you're six, you know, that's kind of fun. Then in my early 20s, it became a wave of darkness that was left to right across my vision and kind of stopped halfway. Some people have really striking and interesting hallucinations. They might be chopping vegetables, and suddenly they'll see literally dozens of fingers where there should only be 5 or 10. Or they'll be looking at someone, talking to someone, and that someone's head will disappear. The rest of them will stay, but the head will disappear, and they can even see the wallpaper through the head. Sort of Cheshire Cat kind of visions. For other people, I interviewed someone who said that she knew she was having a migraine when she's reading a book, and the words on the page disappear, but the pages in the book are still there. Those are sample auras.
And, you know, you described the stars in front of your eyes when you were six, and that makes one think of Vincent van Gogh.
Mm-hmm.
And you described the Cheshire Cat, and you also say that Lewis Carroll, or Charles Dodgson, as he was his real name, had migraines. It almost seemed, reading your book, that almost every great person in history and literature was a migraine sufferer.
Yeah, I got in a little bit of grief about that. I do say at one point, though, that it's just an extremely distinguished list. It doesn't mean that there isn't a whole lot of, a much longer distinguished list that didn't have migraines of any kind. But, you know, Carroll had a diary, said he had migraines. He diagnosed it himself. And Alice in Wonderland is full of a literary representation of a lot of typical migraine hallucinations. Freud was very clear that he had migraines. Darwin was very clear that he had dramatic headaches and that they fueled his art and his craft. Jefferson had terrible headaches. All these people, they wrote it in their diaries. The descriptions are pretty good. We don't want to overdo diagnosing the dead. It's really kind of a, you know, ultimately futile occupation. But when people are telling you they had headaches and the headaches look like migraines, and then they tell you that something they wrote or something that they did had a lot to do with that headache, you listen.
We're speaking with Andrew Levy. His book is A Brain Wider Than the Sky, A Migraine Diary. The title of your book, A Brain Wider Than the Sky, that comes from an Emily Dickinson poem, and you say that she, too, was a migraine sufferer. Tell us about the poem, and you have a marvelous discussion of her language. I mean, you call her, and I think I would agree, possibly the greatest American poet.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this.
That's right, you're up in Amherst. Yeah, well, first of all, I adore Emily Dickinson, period. I think she's an amazing poet who still speaks to us very, very loudly. But technically, I don't actually say in the book that she had migraines because she never said it. I was pretty diligent about that. But she did describe her sister having migraines and had a wonderful line where she said, when the head next to you has a headache, the headache becomes important. But the nature of her she's, whatever it is, the poems that she writes are often just wonderful descriptions of migraine states. My favorite is I Felt a Funeral in My Brain. But the title of the book comes from a different poem where she basically says that the brain is wider than the sky because the brain contains everything in the sky and itself besides, which I think is a sort of beautiful, simple metaphor for a one-to-one relationship with nature that I personally have felt and sort of discovered through having migraines, because many of my migraines happen when there's a thunderstorm coming. So the clouds gather, my brain starts to fog up. The clouds begin to really sort of take on that tepid heat just before a thunderstorm, and I feel that tepid heat inside my brain. And then almost quite literally sometimes there's this call and response between those first flashes of thunder and lightning and the electricity in the air and electricity inside my brain. And then a terrible headache, and then a headache that clears as the atmosphere clears. And a lot of people suffer from migraines due to barometric pressure changes. Again, it's completely explicit. But for me, it's always made me feel like there was this relationship that my brain and the sky are talking. I don't understand the conversation, but to me it feels like they're talking.
That's wonderful, although painful, I know. Now, there are various things that cause migraines. You just pointed to change in the weather. What are some of the different things that can cause migraines?
Oh, gosh. There's migraine triggers are intensely personal. For a lot of women, hormonal changes. Women might start to get migraines during their first pregnancy, for instance, or they might go away during a first pregnancy. For other people, it's weather. For some people, it's sunlight or other kinds of bright light, you know, strobe light on television or in a movie theater, for instance. A lot of people have dietary triggers. A lot of people have a very hard time with alcohol, for instance. But for other people, it could be eggs or it could be chocolate. And then for some people, there are stress-related triggers. It's not that the stress causes the headache, but the stress makes you do something that does cause a headache. You start sleeping badly. Or for a lot of people, they get a migraine when they go on vacation, the first couple of days on vacation. And that can be something as innocent as changing their caffeine intake. Caffeine is also a migraine trigger. So you cut down or you add your caffeine those first couple of days on a vacation, here comes your migraines.
So it's really very different from a muscular, a muscle-caused headache, then.
Right. There are, they're mapping migraine genes. They're looking for the mutations on the genetic, the map of the human gene, and they're finding a lot of different places. And so for one person might have no mutant genes, other person might have three or four or five.
In your book, you also talk about the impact of having migraines on your family. At the time you were writing this book, your son was about 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You are there lying on the couch. I guess your migraines were during the day and then they would abate at night. Is that
right.
correct?
Right.
So, during the day, there you were. There was a wonderful description of you with your head kind of cradled on the couch. And your son, learned to play very quietly.
You know, a lot of people have migraines. They say it's about 12% of all Americans, and about half of those have something pretty disabling. And that comes out to about 23% of all American families have someone with a migraine condition. And that, too, is a lot. And people do not like to talk about the social effects of it. Headache is not really still regarded as a real disease by a lot of people. And when you have a headache and your only witness to the headache is yourself because there's no blood test, there's no obvious disability, you tend to just tough it out. You'll take care of the kids, you'll go to work, you'll function trying to perform those priorities. And yet most migraineurs are compromised when they do. And I wanted to be as honest as I could about that. I mean, I consider myself an extremely good father, but I wanted to show how my son, for instance, might learn to negotiate with the headache, see it coming, and how it would affect, our relationship.
And how did that happen? How did he negotiate your headache?
Well, if he sees me with a headache, with the pillows around my head or an ice pack, he might say, oh, no, not again. I mean, he's a four-year-old. He really wants me to be up and alert to play and be with him and look after him. And if I have to sort of lie there instead, that has got to be a disappointment to him. So to some extent, he compensates, with something else. But at the same time, he also gets these sort of early intuitive lessons in empathy. He helped me, in other words, in ways which I thought were quite amazing. And I also really appreciated that as well. And, of course, I, as a father, would compensate at those times where I wasn't available, or my wife would have to compensate at times when I wasn't available. And all of that ultimately fuels your desire for a cure, to move past this, because you carry around this colossal load of guilt, and you want to be a better father, and being a better father means finding treatment.
So how did your son, Aidan, help you?
One of the classic cures for migraine is pressure applied to the point on the head where the head hurts. And he actually, when he was very, very young, too, in kind of an amazing moment, wrapped himself around my head in such a way that he applied pressure to the points and literally made me feel better, not just because that was the cure, but because he did it. It was an amazing moment for he and me. Another way he helped me, which sounds kind of counterintuitive, is that he fought with the headache. If I said I had a headache, he would jump on my head and shoulders and pound at them, a three-year-old kind of playfully doing it. And in some ways, the fact that he would do that, that he didn't take it seriously, that he didn't regard it necessarily as a somber intrusion, lifted my spirits and also sort of compelled me to want to sort of rise above the migraines myself.
And your wife, how did this impact your marriage?
Well, you hear a lot of talk about headaches and marriage, and that's gone back 150 years. And the classic model is of course the famous cliche of the wife saying, "I have not tonight, dear. I have a headache," and that the husband sort of suspecting that it's not really a headache, but it's a desire to withdraw from him socially in some form. That dynamic doesn't really change. I mean, you cancel. It was a Saturday night dinner party that your wife was looking forward to, and you can't make it, and that's a disappointment to her. Or you need to lie in bed for 8 hours, and you're not a high-maintenance patient, so to speak. I mean, you just need to be left alone. But being left alone takes its toll. you know, there's kinds of communication a husband and a wife or a boyfriend and a girlfriend or anyone else want to have. And if this migraine just sort of locks down and makes one person inaccessible for long periods of time, it has an impact on the relationship.
And how did that ultimately play out? I mean, what kinds of accommodations did your wife make and you make? And was there a way in which you were able, in fact, to strengthen your communication in spite of the headache or maybe because of it?
Right. Well, I do think that the communication, in the end, we both realized how precious it was. So that as we move forward, we valued kinds of conversation in society that we might have taken for granted before. In the short term, I mean, she had to do more of everything, but at that same time, I was also absolutely obsessive about making sure I did my fair share of the chores, that I did X, Y, and Z as well, that I was not an imposition. And in a certain sense, that stoicism isn't necessarily the smartest thing to do. And I kind of learned to move beyond that, too, just as I think she learned beyond understanding that it wasn't anything to take personal or necessarily to take seriously. You know, basically, the idea that once you have a chronic pain condition that your spouse has to become your nurse, I think is one I would challenge a little bit. I think that there's love is more complex than that, and I think you simply have to continue to work to find the ways to renew your love.
Could you say a little more about that, how you were able to renew your... You know, this is interesting because I think many people do confront this. I have an elderly mother who... as she is now up here with me, she has many chronic health problems. I have to take care of her a lot, but it actually has incredibly deepened our connection. We've had to work through certain things that we were able to just kind of put on hold all our lives. Mm-hmm. And now that she's 89, we are solving them. And I wondered if that's some of what you're talking about.
That is, and I think that's beautifully put, by the way, which is that it's a change in the dynamic of a relationship, if you're a smart person, can be a change for the better, even if at first it looks like a change for the worse. You know, the thing about a migraine, as is the case with most chronic pain conditions, is that you're usually not in it all the time. But even in it, you can find means of finding happiness and communicating with each other. I have a couple who's a friend of mine, and the wife gets migraines pretty frequently, and she usually finds a way to signal to her husband fairly early in the day what's happening, and he kind of goes along with it. She'll say something like, I'm feeling like a migraine today. We're going to walk very slowly today, by which she means I need to walk slowly. I need to sort of not, you know, that's going to prevent the migraine from coming on. No sudden moves here. And he goes with it. He has a slow day. And the slow day is good for him, too, because he needs a day off every once in a while.
That's beautiful. We're talking with Andrew Levy about migraines. His book is A Brain Wider Than the Sky. I'd like to ask you about some of the more metaphysical aspects. I mean, we talked about the spiritual, but you also say that migraine is a way that makes you reimagine the real.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you take there are a set of migraine symptoms, aura symptoms, which are actually called Alice in Wonderland syndrome, because Alice in Wonderland had them, or, you know, where you suddenly think you're 9 feet tall, or you suddenly think you're 9 inches tall. And there is great descriptions of how actual sufferers with this syndrome get used to it very quickly. First time they freak out. But then the second time, the third time, they just say, okay, I feel like I'm 9 feet tall, but I'm still sitting here, you know, in my cubicle with my computer, so obviously I'm not 9 feet tall. And the difference with migraine hallucinations and other kinds of hallucinations is they never really possess you. You don't think you're 9 feet tall. You just are struck by the amazing sensation of feeling 9 feet tall. But your sanity remains. And I think that changes what you think reality looks and feels like. Because you know now that hallucinations are part of what the human brain does routinely. They're not a trick. They're not an aberration. It's part of the system.
So are you saying that because your reality changes, your perception of reality changes, that then when you are even not in a migraine state, you understand that reality itself is subjective?
Absolutely. There's no question about that. There's just a humility. You realize that the human brain is programmed to show you a variety of perspectives on what the real world looks and feels like. It doesn't mean that things necessarily change at base, but you develop this kind of, oh, I don't know, almost kind of subconscious acceptance of relativism. Part of it is just that the mood changes itself. I mean, a migraine is so dramatically different from what happens and what happens before it and what happens after it that you accept that your life is more about these highs and lows and these dramatic changes that you don't really have control over. And I think that in itself is cathartic and a little bit dangerous. But that's part of the migrainey way of looking at things. The highs are higher, the lows are lower, but it's not because you're crazy or you're living badly. It's just because, you know, the serotonin has been up and down. The electricity is clicking on and off.
In your book, A Brain Wider Than the Sky, you contrast Buddhism and Christianity in their approach to pain, and you say they both have something to say about what pain has to offer.
Yeah, I did this little analogy with Buddhism, where the idea of much Buddhist meditation is to sort of sweep the mind clear. And what I suggested is that when you're in the throes of a migraine, when you're just waiting for the next throb of pain, the migraine itself does a beautiful job of sweeping your mind clear. And so you actually are kind of meditating, except for the migraine itself, those throbs. So it's kind of a perverse twist on a Buddhist concept. As far as Christianity was concerned, I basically suggested that a lot of world religions don't really take their shape until the deity feels incredible disabling pain, that world religions grapple and understand this concept as being a universal, and that it starts a longer time ago. Horus from Egyptian mythology had a terrible headache. They asked Isis to lower a new head for him, and it was clearly a migraine he was describing. His symptoms were very clear. And through Christianity, there was always actually, up until around 1500 AD, a real close bond between treatment of migraine and prayer to Jesus Christ specifically, who, because he was crucified on the hill at Calvary, which was, which is known as the head stowing place because it was covered with skulls, that when people were praying for the relief of migraines in 1000 or 1200 or 1400 AD, they would pray to Jesus in particular. He had a special power for treating head pain. And that has disappeared, but 1,000 years ago they understood that link.
And so for Buddhism, migraine is like a mantra.
Yes, that's right. You're supposed to have this one thing which clears your head, right? And it happens to be that throb, that boom, that boom. And in between, it's amazing how empty you feel, or at least me. I mean, I just lie there at this empty, 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 boom, empty, 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 boom, empty, 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 boom. And I can feel the exact contour of the boom, And that's an incredible sort of activity in self-knowledge. And it's a kind of training, since it can go on for hours and hours.
Andrew Levy, now that you've written this book, do you still have migraines?
Yeah, actually I have more than before the book, but they're more treatable, which is better.
Would you have it any other way, or would you just as soon have never had migraines to begin with?
Yeah, and I'd rather not have them. I mean, a lot of the nature of this conversation has been to suggest that there are positives, and I think that what I'm trying to do is, in my own way, help with suggestions that might help other people. At the same time, I think it would be fatuous to say that I'm glad I had them. Not true.
Well, I think your book, A Brain Wider Than the Sky, is not only helpful to people with migraines, but also to people without them, because I think we all experience pain in our lives. And the lessons that you bring forth here, the thoughtfulness and the eloquence which you bring to them, I can attest, is a real comfort to the heart.
Well, thank you very much for those kind words.
Andrew Levy teaches English and is the director of the Writer's Studio at Butler University. He's the author of several books, including The First Emancipation, and his work has appeared in Harper's Magazine, Dissent, and Best American Essays. Here's his favorite Emily Dickinson poem, I Felt a Funeral in My Brain. I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, treading, till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as all the heavens were a bell, and being but an ear, and I and silence, some strange race wrecked, solitary here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing then. Emily Dickinson's A Funeral in My Brain. Next up, we hear from David Lovelace about the highs and lows of bipolar disorder. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Bipolar disorder has carved a wide swath through the psyche of David Lovelace's family. He, his father, his mother, and his brother all suffer from the illness. Only his sister escaped. But as Lovelace writes in his powerful memoir, Scattershot, being bipolar isn't all bad. If the extremes of the disorder, once called manic depression, are controlled through medication, it can bring great creativity and artistic gifts to those who are under its sway. Lovelace is a poet as well as a memoirist. He's also former owner of the Montague Book Mill, a much-loved institution in the picturesque rural town of Montague, Massachusetts. We spoke to David Lovelace in October of 2008. Well, David Lovelace, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
The book is like a circle. It begins and ends roughly at the same place, when you got the call that your parents were in trouble, and this was already after you yourself had experienced bipolar disorder. Tell us what happened. What was going on?
Well, the book opens in 2005 when there was a crisis with my folks. This is 20 years after we first experienced the manic breaks that characterize the disease. I got a series of phone calls from my father on the answering machine, and each one was looser than the next, and it was clear to me that he was manic. He was full blown, and because I've seen it before and I've experienced it myself, so I drove straight down to Northampton. And he wouldn't let me in the apartment. He said everything was fine, but clearly I could see in, and trash was everywhere, and he was completely disheveled. And I asked to see my mother through the door, and he said she was resting, and I couldn't see her. And finally, I wrenched open the door, and I came in. At which point he sat back down and said, okay, fine. And I went upstairs and I found my mother on the floor, catatonic.
And what were your feelings as you came upon this scene?
I was horrified. I mean, it was a very scary situation. I mean, I love my dad and I've always gotten along with him. I've never felt threatened by him or experienced any violence in all the years in our family. But at that point, when I heard him coming up the stairs after I found my mother and then standing in the doorway and sort of smiling at me, I was petrified. In fact, I bailed out of the apartment. I couldn't wake my mother up. I bailed out of the apartment and I called the cops because I knew I couldn't just call an ambulance because my father wouldn't let them in.
Now, your dad didn't manifest symptoms of bipolar disorder until he was in his 50s, is that right?
That's right. That's very late. I mean, the average onset age for the disease is really in the early 20s. One of the saddest things about the disease is it hits people just as they're entering into adulthood and really taking steps to choose their future and create a path. And it can cut you off at the knees. But my father, he is a brilliant man. He's a scholar, scholar, church history scholar. Looking back now in hindsight, I can see that he had compartmentalized and guarded his emotions to some degree. But in 1986, he just out of the blue had a full-blown manic attack. He stopped making sense. He stopped sleeping. He stopped eating. He was threatening. It was pretty scary, and he was hospitalized.
And how old were you at this time?
I was 26. My mother had suffered with mental illness all my life, and she so I was familiar with the depressive side of the disease. She was hospitalized in 1949 originally and diagnosed schizophrenic. Most people with mental illness were diagnosed schizophrenic in those days. She had periodic bouts of depression that left her almost mute, very paranoid, and withdrawn. But my father's episode, this was the first manic break, the other side of the disease. When that happened to him, it was almost a premonition of what was in store for us. I had always been fearful of mental illness, always felt that I had it within me. And when I saw my father go off and be, you know, dragged off by the cops, I became quite scared, and I just bailed. I bailed on my family when they needed me the most. I left the country. I went to Central America. I went to Belize and Guatemala and just sort of hid out there.
Yeah, and when you did, now, you had already, or you had not yet experienced a break of your own?
I had suffered some severe depressions. One was in high school, and then one was in college. So I knew that there were times when my mind would not function properly.
You have very powerful descriptions of both the mania and the depression that occur with bipolar disorder. And I've read a lot about bipolar disorder, but I've never had the sense of what it was like to experience a manic or a depressive episode quite like this, particularly the manic. And I wonder if you could read a few paragraphs from a page I'm going to give you here.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, your description of mania especially was stunning and frightening and also attractive in some ways. I mean, you talk about the beautiful cartwheel of thoughts that pitch and crash.
Yeah.
I'd like you to read this section here. It's on page 178, just starting out at the bottom of the page, 178, and then you'll be going down to right here. And just set us up. Tell us where you are.
Okay. This is when I entered into my first manic break. I'd been getting speedier and speedier leading up to this. I had I was in what they call a hypomanic state, talking fast, not sleeping much. But when you enter into the full-blown manic state, then your mind is moving so fast that things are just tumbling through it. And you start talking nonstop because you want to prove that all these little bits and pieces that are flying through your brain, all these connections, actually do make sense. And if you could slow them down, I think you could make sense of them. But you can't, so it comes out as gobbledygook. And I think that's the heart of the madness. I mean, you realize that everything is connected. It's an ecstatic experience to realize that. And then you try to express that, and of course, you can't because your mind is flying from one connection to another. So when this description comes from the part where I first entered into mania, and this was in Olympia, Washington, after I'd come back up from Guatemala. Thought rose out of its bank, and it spilled through sex, God, and dreams, mysterious places the mind should not trespass. Mania flooded my tidy little village of memory and constructs, the sunny little place where I play, where I keep my desires amused. All lines fell and connections sparked and went black and hissed through the water. What I knew of the world mutated continually, all of a huge metaphor now, broken and heavy and rolling straight toward me. When I pulled on a thought, it unraveled to trees, asphalt, spilled horizons, and suns. I needed to look away, and I knew it was already too late. I was blind and just babbling. This is it, I thought. This is madness, and my family was chosen. I wanted my father, my brother, and I knew I could talk with them now, that I could meet them out on electric fields. I knew why my father held hands and tried to share these visions, and I knew why my brother punched him out trying to save them. My thoughts moved so fast they began to hum, and that humming was music, absolutely sublime movement strafed with dissonance and 12-tone. My father sang all his hymns because everything did. 20 years later, I know this music well. It's symphonic and fast, and above all, it's inclusive and sung by everything, every tree, rock, and smokestack. These song cycles draw a skein up under experience, increasing its tempos, tightening the harmonies, connecting it all. There's a transcendental romance to mania, to this drawing together. And I believed, still believe, that this music is true, that the scattershot vision of madness are holy.
When I read that, it reminded me of my first acid trip.
Yeah.
And I also had the sense of everything being connected.
Yeah.
And I felt that that was real. So say something about this. You've had the experience of madness as madness. You've had the experience of it as ecstasy, of it as depression. Where do you find the place of what's true and what's not?
I'd say that experience or the psychedelic experience is similar, but madness is doing it without a net. You don't know that it's going to end, and you truly think, well, this is it. No one's ever going to be able to hold me again because I'm gone. I'm completely alone now. I think that one of the things that happens when you experience clinical depression is that you gain an incredible amount of empathy for others. You don't know it when you're going through it. You don't know much of anything when you're going through it. But you do gain that empathy. But at the same time, you become, or at least this happened for me, I spent years afraid of sadness. And that's a real crippling thing if you can't experience your sadness. If every time you feel sad, you feel like, well, this is a harbinger of depression and I need to stay happy, that's neurotic.
So you're saying that actually you had to constrict your emotional world because to go too far into one or the other direction could be a harbinger of insanity.
Right. And you begin to distrust your emotions, or you can. And especially if you're not actively working through the issues that come with bipolar illness, if you're just trying to deny it or pretend that, okay, I may be bipolar, but all I have to do is take this pill, all I have to do is take this lithium, and everything's fine. Lithium is very powerful, and it's a godsend, but it doesn't get to the heart of a lot of things. I mean, you have to work through quite a bit. As far as the mania goes, a lot of artistic people, a lot of creative people, you know, taking drugs, taking medicine for what they consider to be their muse is an anathema, and they suffer quite a bit.
These are people who have who are bipolar.
Yeah, and it was me.
And are taking their medicine because they feel, does it damp their creativity?
It can. One thing I want to say is that bipolar illness is the most lethal mental illness there is. 1 out of 5 people who aren't treated for it commit suicide. And yet it's the most treatable. Lithium remains the gold standard for treatment. Now, if you take too much lithium, it makes you feel lead-headed. You can feel like there's a ceiling that you can't go over. after many years dealing with psychiatrists and finding one that I really like, I've been able to lower my dose to the point where I can still see the world spark. I can get into those fugue states just enough, those hypomanic states where I can write poetry and I'm on a roll, I'm in the zone for days on end, but I can also go to bed. You know, and I get up in the morning and put the kids on the bus.
It actually sounds, I've heard this from other people who are bipolar also, that there is that there's a great attraction to the manic state, that it's something that you feel, you know, better than well.
Yeah, yeah, you do. I mean, it's very seductive. I mean, there's a point, and it's a quicksilver moment, when you feel that you are a god, you know? And then all of a sudden, then you realize what a frightening thought that actually is.
Well, what is it like? What does it feel like to feel like a god?
What is it? Crazy. It is a very seductive, like that hypomanic state, that quicksilver time when your mind is moving quickly and it's fluid and you're very clever and things sparkle, is a beautiful moment, but it doesn't last. It veers off into this paranoid roller coaster and quickly becomes really dangerous. So, like everything else, I think there's a balance for people to achieve with this illness. I think it's a gift. I really am actually pretty proud to be bipolar.
And yet you are also, you hold nothing back in terms of showing the dark side of it.
Yeah. Either. Oh, yeah. I'm proud of going through those things. And I'm proud of what I've learned through those things.
The other aspect of your book that's so interesting is kind of the interplay between madness and religious ecstasy.
Yeah.
Say something about that.
Well, my father, when I was young, my father was a Presbyterian minister. He was very popular among the teenagers, but the rest of the church wasn't quite sure what to make of him.
And why was that?
Well, he was eccentric. He rode motorcycles and he collected snakes, and he was, boy, when I was 7, he gave me a copy of Bob Dylan, Highway 61 Revisited. So he was definitely to the left of the congregation. Our depressions, and this is generally how the illness manifests itself with teens, is the first thing that happens is the first thing that comes is the depressions. And these severe depressions, both my mother's and then my own and then my brother's, were shunted into the spiritual realm. My father talked a lot about the dark night of the soul.
And he was proud of you and your first depression.
Yeah, yeah, he was. He kind of bragged about it, that I was being tried and tested. And in a way, that was encouraging. But in another way, it was... I didn't really feel that was going on. I felt that my mind was becoming sluggish and slowing down. I felt a great deal of disgust with my body and my life. But it wasn't until the mania in 1986 when my father went off, and then my brother went off 3 months later, and then I went off 3 months after that. So it happened, boom, boom, boom. And when the mania came along, I think it was difficult for my father to spiritualize that, to plug God into that equation.
And why was that? Because so often mania is,
ecstatic.
Is ecstatic, exactly.
I think he was more comfortable with the dark night of the soul.
We're talking with David Lovelace about his memoir, Scattershot, My Bipolar Family. You talk in the book so much about, and we've already talked here about the connections that are made, you know, that objects become imbued with meaning.
Yes.
And that everything is connected to everything else. There's a scene in the book where you've been taken into the home of some friends who have kind of rescued you from the situation you're in just prior to them putting you in the hospital, and you come into their home and they go out to the movies for a couple of hours, and you take everything out of your pack. You've returned from Guatemala here. You take all kinds of objects from their house and you arrange it all.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that seems crazy. On the other hand, I thought about how artists also put objects together and how this is a meaning-making enterprise, basically. Again, that kind of thin line between madness and meaning. And I just, can you say something about meaning and making meaning within the state of madness?
Well, I think it's interesting to note, you know, a high percentage of artists suffer from bipolar illness. And of them, a strikingly high percentage of them are poets. And I think it's the free associative power that comes from that. The ability, your mind, this sounds negative, but your mind short circuits. It makes a jump, an intuitive jump, and you can connect two things that don't necessarily belong together. And I think that the strongest, at least in my poetry, the strongest poetic images are those, where two things that are wildly dissimilar are laid side by side and make a connection.
Yeah, and along the way, you got on lithium, you met your wife, you came up to this area here, Montague, and you kind of fell into this book mill.
Yeah.
And then you lost it because you stopped taking your medicine.
Oh, I didn't lose the book mill. I was involved in building a cafe there, which exists now. And I was going to be a partner in the cafe. And then I stopped taking my lithium. And I had a manic break. And that freaked out my business partners on that venture. But I stepped out of the cafe, but kept the bookstore.
And why did you stop taking your lithium?
Because I had been well for so long. I felt I didn't need it. It was high summer. It was late June. Just beautiful. The days were just beautiful. I was excited about this project. I just felt really well. And I decided, well, I'm just going to go off my lithium and I'm going to see what happens. I mean, I can always go back on. It's not that big a deal. And, of course, what happens is when things start to speed up, the last thing you want to do is slow them down. When you move into that hyper-creative state, that hypomania, you don't want to go back on lithium. You don't want to slow it down. And you don't, obviously you're not thinking that clearly, and you don't want to admit that you're not making sense. So I was fortunate in that my family was away. My family was in Gloucester, where we're originally from, and I was going to meet them in a week or two. I was fortunate in that I've always been open with my friends about my experiences being bipolar. And some friends down at the book mill put two and two together, and they came up and intervened.
They did, but your partners decided they didn't want to go ahead with the enterprise with you. Was that connected with that?
It was a little bit of both. I mean, I was pretty humiliated, even though fresh out of something like this, you're fairly humiliated. And I didn't want to take on a project like that. And they hadn't experienced anything quite like that. They were genuinely freaked. And it was a good decision. I was the one that decided, well, I don't need to be in this project. I'll just stick with the books.
So what's it like being on the other side of other people's fear?
Well, scary. Because their fear makes you frightened. And what happens is you want to reassure everybody. You start talking faster and faster, trying to explain what's going on. Don't worry. This all makes sense. I can prove that I'm making sense, and you make less and less sense. And paranoia, that's where the paranoia kicks in, of course, and then anger, and then that's when things can get violent. I've never been violent, but
if you had to give advice to people who were in a situation where they didn't know much about bipolar disorder, they were confronting somebody with it, what would you tell them?
Well, you rarely confront people who are depressed because generally they're in a dark room by themselves. Folks that are obviously manic, I think that you can play along to some degree. I think people get really defensive around folks that aren't making sense. They get really scared. I think to some degree you have to have a sense of humor about all. There's an absurdity to the whole thing, and then if you roll with that absurdity, you can make a friend, and you can gain someone's trust, and then go from there. If you just start telling them that, well, you're not making any sense, you're sounding crazy, then they're just going to get angry and react.
And do people who are full blown, as you say, do they know that something's wrong?
Yes, deep down, yes, and that's part of that. I think that feeds the paranoia too. I mean, in the panic, when the panic sets in, when things really stop making sense, and your body, you know, you're wired. You don't need to sleep. You couldn't sleep if you wanted to. After a week of that, you know something's wrong, and you just start to almost flail. It's like drowning. It's kind of scary to come upon someone who's drowning. They're flailing out and thrashing wildly, and I think that's what people do. As far as advice for families and folks, I think what's interesting to me, and I'm learning more about it now daily, is when I came of age in the 80s, nobody wanted to be diagnosed mentally ill at all. People avoided it like the plague. It was scary. And now, I think partly because of the onset of the antidepressant, the SSRIs and stuff, it's more accepted, and people are more willing to and almost desirous of having a label. They're willing to get. I've had a number of friends call me up and say, I think I'm bipolar. You know, Dave, good news.
And do you think it's being overdiagnosed?
It's certainly moving in that direction. I think that it is the diagnosis du jour right now, just as ADHD was a couple of years ago. I'm hoping that my book won't romanticize it. I'm hoping people who read my book, the people who are bipolar, will take comfort in it. The people who aren't going to run off to their doctor and say, you know, give me some drugs. I also think that folks need to explore this from the ground up. They need to go to a therapist and discuss all these issues. And then if they decide to use medicine, I would suggest that people see a psychiatrist rather than just a family doctor.
Because the as you say, it's a brain disease.
Yeah, it's a brain disease, and it's a specialty, and the neuroscience is just galloping along, and I don't think, you know, general doctors can keep up with it.
Well, David Lovelace, thanks so much for coming and talking with us here about Scattershot.
Well, thanks. It was a pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Scattershot is David Lovelace's first nonfiction book. His poetry has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize and the Patterson Review's Allen Ginsberg Award. You can find more information and links about bipolar disorder and migraine at writersvoice.net, as well as images of art created by people with the conditions. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.